Seekers, because I love you, here's part one of a special three-part Conspiracy Month bonus show just for you.
Robert Mayer's witty and riveting novel, IJFK, in which the young president dictates from heaven his memories of the days of Camelot, performed by Bruce Watson and Paula Strongheart Garfield.
The problem at this late hour is how to begin. What to offer after all you have seen, heard, and read that will rivet your soul? I am tempted to quote from the maps of ancient mariners as they sailed into uncharted waters. Here be demons. Or, to tell you the name of my favorite poem, which I read to my bride on our wedding night, I have a rendezvous with death. But all of us, heroes and fools, have demons. Each of us, knight and knave, has his own private rendezvous with death. In a world without shadows, the shadows lengthen nonetheless, before all is darkness, or all is light. I must get on with it. So I shall simply choose a time and place and begin. November morn slipped in through the windows. In the rose garden, a songbird trilled. Signing state papers, I checked my calendar of sailing ships, the 21st. My wife entered the office without knocking.
Which suit would you like me to wear?
She was holding a draped hanger in each hand.
The navy or the pink?
It was a curious question. She rarely consulted me about her clothing. Her sense of style, if not her sense of humor, was notorious. The pink. All those tired cowgirls raising their brat kids to be Miss America. They adore pink in Texas. I swung my legs down from the desk. My loafers needed a shine. I wondered if Raymond was at his post yet. Perhaps I should have chosen the dark blue. Man, my blood would not have photographed on the blue. Perhaps I should have listened. The road was not taken. The book is a patent fraud. It doesn't ring with Kennedy's rhythms, Kennedy's cadences. So wrote the Times critic. Ask not. Let the word go forth. The torch has been passed. Understand, those were Sorensen's words. I was not just the mouthpiece. I was the heart and soul to which he grafted himself. But the perfection of the words, the marching syllables, were his. Here among ghosts, there are no ghost riders. I know you want to hear about Marilyn, Hoffa, Khrushchev, Sinatra, Oswald. Patience, patience. I shall illuminate all.
You wanted me, Mr. President?
Raymond, my valet, said, entering the room. My first day in office, the evening of the inaugural balls, he came up to my bedroom wearing a brown suit, a white shirt, and a yellow tie. You always shine shoes in a suit and tie?
I do when it's the president's shoes.
That's nonsense, Raymond. If overalls and flannel shirts are good enough for Harvard Yard, they're damn well good enough for Pennsylvania Avenue. His dark brow furrowed.
With all respects, Mr. President, I don't think that's right.
You don't? What about humility, Raymond? I shouldn't lose my humility, should I? Just because I am now the most powerful man in the world? Given the arsenal of secret weapons I've been reading about, the most powerful man since Adam. You don't want that to go to my head, do you?
No, sir.
It didn't go to Mr. Lincoln's head, did it?
I didn't know the man, sir.
Come, come, Raymond. You've read all about President Lincoln. Do you think Abe Lincoln would have wanted a man to shine his shoes wearing a silk tie and a suit?
I reckon Mr. Lincoln shined his own shoes.
I looked at the gilt clock on the mantelpiece. It's getting late, Raymond. Shine the shoes.
Yes, sir, Mr. President.
Then we both guffawed. I moved forward and embraced him. He in the only suit he owned, me in my pale blue boxer shorts. We passed several seconds that way, our hearts musing against each other's chest. I'm glad you agreed to come, I said, when we separated.
I wouldn't miss it for the world. The next 4 years are going to be fun.
Eight, Raymond. Eight.
Yes, sir, Mr. President. Eight.
I need a shine, Raymond. I'm going to Texas to kick some ass. A gracious gentleman always gets a shine before he kicks ass. He came around the desk with his box and folding stool. He began to do his work. His brown hands flitted across my shoes like the wings of a large hummingbird, as always, never hesitating, never faltering, never soiling a sock. Say this for the shoeshine man. He never had a bay of pigs.
I hear they don't like you in Texas.
Have you been reading the FBI reports again?
Just a few, Mr. President. Just a few.
Ah, that Bobby. Can't learn to keep his mouth shut.
Seriously, sir, that's what I hear.
They don't like anybody in Texas, Raymond. Most of all, they don't like each other. It's the Hatfields and the McCoys down there. Got to straighten things out before it costs us the next election.
Can't Mr. Lyndon do that?
You would think so, wouldn't you? A man so desperate to run the country, you'd think he could keep his own house in order.
That's what you'd think.
When he was through, my loafers shined like a moonlit sea. I walked with him across the office. I had a strong, strange impulse to shake his hand, but it was greasy with polish.
Have a good trip, Mr. President.
I will. I will. Kicking ass in Texas. Make a good country song, don't you think?
Make a very good country song, sir.
As you've already surmised, my intent here is not to write a linear autobiography. All that David Copperfield kind of crap, as Salinger, no, Pierre, said. You can find that in the encyclopedias. That is the torment, it turns out, of fame, of power. Your memory lives on, but in the words of others, dry as proverbial dust. It doesn't matter if they loved you or hated you. It's all brittle stuff. And it's them, of course, not you. The Bible, I dare say, got it backward. In the end, there is the word. Unless, of course, what we call the end is only the beginning. They haven't told me that yet. What we are permitted in this brief afterlife is 25 years of memory. A quarter century in which to look back, reflect, consider. Repenting is optional. Then all memory vanishes, like a blackboard erased. Consciousness disappears or moves on to the next step. They haven't told me that yet either. I am using my last allotment of time before it vanishes entirely to set down some reflections, some scenes, private views of public scenes, anything that will lift the dust. My friends, my family, my women, thought they were serving me well by keeping secrets. Naked before mine enemies. Naked before my God. If others find shame in this, let them deal with their own gods. They will in any case. In time they will. A word about accuracy. What I shall set down is the truth. Otherwise, why bother? But unlike Bobby, I have always been a sucker for subtlety. So pay attention. I would not have sent in troops. Advisors, yes, but green boys to die in jungles, no. You do not defend freedom by the light of burning Buddhists. 58,000 boys still alive. 100,000 children never born. You cut your losses. I would not, I think, have sent in troops. On the other hand, there was McNamara, Rusk, Bundy, Bobby, the best and the brightest. My own dear Hawks might have convinced me. So I might have sent in troops. I think not. After the Cuban crisis, there was no further need to prove my macho, to show my balls. God, the sea was cold. We were not torpedoed. A Jap destroyer simply sliced us in half at midnight and continued on its way. We clung to the hull of the boat. The Japs did not bother to finish us off. Nor did they bother to rescue us, to take us as prisoners. The captain, I have convinced myself, died 1,000 deaths in the afterburns of Nagasaki. Two of my men were killed on impact. One was the officer of the deck. I do not know why we got no warning from the officer of the deck. My back felt broken. 10 of us survived. We clung to the broken boat till dawn. Then I ordered them to swim to an island visible in the distance. The more we swam, the more the island receded. A junior officer was hurt too badly to swim. I lugged him along with me through the salt. It was 4 hours later that we washed up at last on the beach. I do not know why we got no warning from the officer of the deck. I do know that Oswald didn't act alone. In the spring of 58, I spoke at a Democratic fundraiser in Los Angeles, raising money for the midterm elections. Also collecting IOUs for 1960. After my speech, Billy Wilder approached. I'd met him years before. Hollywood was good Democratic money in those days, and I'd always been interested in showbiz, of which politics is the historical, the archival branch. Wilder said he was in the middle of shooting a film with some stars it might be useful for me to meet. He invited me to visit the set the next morning. The film was Some Like It Hot. In a studio on the United Artists lot, the interior of a railroad coach had been created. Technicians and lighting men were bustling about. A few minutes after I arrived, Wilder escorted the three stars onto the set. They were all wearing lovely dresses. Mr. Wilder introduced me. I don't think you folks have met. Senator Kennedy of Massachusetts, I'd like you to meet the Andrews sisters, I asked. Tony Curtis guffawed. Jack Lemmon smiled. Marilyn Monroe's expression didn't change. Wilder completed the introductions. I shook hands with both actors and turned to Marilyn.
Charmed, I'm sure.
Monroe did a deep curtsy. She was wearing that spangled dress that the film would make famous. She was all there. If I may ask, without giving away trade secrets, why are you in drag?
I'm not.
She was straight-faced. Her lips had that pouty, deadpan innocence she used so effectively on the screen. I wasn't sure if she was in character or if that was the real her. Her voice called over me. It was Jackie's voice, exactly. I wondered for the first, but not for the last time, if Jackie, somewhere, somehow, had copied it with some precise intent. In the railroad car, the lights went out. Someone called out, "Ready on the set." The nice to have met you senators took only a moment. Lemon and Curtis followed Wilder to the set. I was left alone with Marilyn, and for the first time in my life, I could think of nothing to say. In the awkward silence, I sputtered as usual onto Bobby as a fall guy. My brother wanted me to ask you something. He wants to know what Arthur Miller has that he doesn't have. Marilyn Monroe smiled.
While your brother was working for Joe McCarthy, my husband was writing The Crucible.
I tried not to wince, but I felt as if she'd slugged me, and Bobby, and Pop, and even great-grandfather Patrick Kennedy, who sailed for America when the potatoes in Ireland turned black. I decided that at that moment I would take her to bed one day. What I said was, I didn't know you were interested in politics.
You don't have to hit 56 straight to know which team you're on.
I couldn't believe what I was hearing, as if I was out of my league with this dumb blonde. Bobby was young then.
Yes, and you were sick.
The bitch was amazing. I take it then that I'll have your full support in 1960? Her eyes danced lightly. I'd scored a point at last.
I'm for Adley.
Adley's wonderful, but he's a two-time loser.
So am I.
Again, our eyes didn't waver. We were staring into windows of the sea. I was sailing alone into perilous waters, and I felt exhilarated. It was she who broke the silence.
Do you think a pretty face is enough?
Obviously, you've got a lot more going for you than a pretty face. Marilyn frowned.
I was referring to you.
I wanted to smile, but I was much too angry. Or frustrated. I couldn't tell if she was serious or was putting me on. About everything. She looked at me coolly, levelly.
Perhaps.
Then she was needed on the set. We shook hands. No more deep curtsies. And what had that been about? She turned and walked away in that almost dress, her buttocks grinding, the mills of the gods. Yes, I thought. Yes. And ambled after her. And watched her sing Runnin' Wild. Another take was ordered. I watched her sing it a second time. Then I left to catch a plane, a true believer. I knew we would meet again. Inga Binga, Inga Binga, Inga Binga. Some people scar your soul. Later, in the worst of times, during the Bay of Pigs or during the Cuban blockade when we were risking the end of human history, and no sane man could sleep, I would lie awake in Abe Lincoln's bed, restless, mind searing out of control, and then, to relax, I would say the words, over and over, a litany, a catechism, an om. Inga binga, inga binga, inga binga. And drift to sleep on the gentle waves of her inga binga. She was a former Miss Denmark. I will let you imagine her beauty, her roundnesses, the texture of her fair skin. She was working that war-torn summer of 42 as a reporter for the Washington Times Herald. I was an ensign junior grade in the Navy, assigned to a desk in naval intelligence, eager for sea duty but unable to get it. I had hoped to be a journalist myself after the war. Her real name was only Inga. Naked, she was Inga Binga. We played games in hotel rooms. We played games in an apartment we shared. We talked. We fucked. We talked. J. Edgar Hoover taped all of it. The talking and the fucking both. What Inga neglected to tell me between mouthfuls, this bright young officer in naval intelligence, was that she had once attended the wedding of Hermann Göring, whose best man was Adolf Hitler, that she had spoken with Der Führer afterward, that the FBI believed she was a Nazi sympathizer, that the FBI suspected that she might be a Nazi spy. Some in the Navy wanted to kick me out. Pop had connections. Pop pulled strings. I was reassigned to the sea duty I wanted so desperately. The sea, it's been said, engulfs you like a woman. The destroyer split us asunder. For 4 hours I swam, clenching between my teeth a strap of the life jacket of Pat McMahon, my wounded chief engineer. For this, they wrote me up as a hero, the commander of PT-109. McMahon had died, gurgling, vomiting seawater. It was a small step in 1946 from hero to congressman. Ask now what your country can do for you, Inga Binga. I don't know what happened to her after I went to sea. I do know what happened to the tapes. J. Edgar kept them in his private file. They colored all that happened afterwards.
What are you doing?
Writing, I replied to Lyndon.
Why?
That's what I was supposed to do when I left office. An ex-president at 51. So I'm, writing.
Will you tell them it wasn't me?
Of course, I replied to Lyndon.
Some people think it was me. Happening right there in Dallas. Why did they have to do it in Texas? Probably to make people think it was me.
He paces about in the flannel nightshirt, the flannel cap.
You promise now you'll tell them it wasn't.
Yes, I'll tell them the blood on your hands came later, Lyndon. He stops pacing. He pulls at his ear.
You are a bastard, Jack. You know that.
So I've been told.
You needed me. If I hadn't carried Texas for you, the weasel would have won the election. You used me and tossed me aside like a whore.
You didn't carry Texas, Lyndon. You got the Board of Elections to disqualify 80,000 Nixon votes in order to carry Texas.
Exactly. And did you ever show any gratitude?
I don't answer. He's right, of course. But he's not exactly the kind of person you invite to dinner. That's what Jackie used to say. My older brother, Joe Jr., was a bully. Ask Bobby. Ask Teddy. Ask Eunice. He was big and strong, and since I was the next boy in line, I was the one he always beat up. Win! 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 My father screams in the soundtrack of my youth. At Hyannisport, we all had to be on the beach at 8 o'clock every morning for calisthenics. A hired gym teacher grunted us through our exercises while my father watched from the porch. Then there would be the races. Swimming races, sailing races, bicycle races. My father screamed, Win! 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 Joe held my head under water and won. Joe sank my boat and won. Joe rammed my bike. I needed 22 stitches to get the bleeding to stop. And he won. Joe was going to be president someday. I was the sickly one. Most likely I would write books, like the ones I spread across the beds of my youth. Then came the Medal for Bravery, PT-109. Joe couldn't stand it. Jack was a hero, and Joe hadn't even seen combat yet. He'd show me he would. He volunteered for a dangerous assignment. German V-1 rockets were devastating London. The launch sites in France had to be destroyed, and saturation bombing hadn't taken them out.
What the Allies were going to do was pack airplanes full of explosives.
A pilot would get them into the air, set them on course for precise impact on a launching site. A mother plane would arm the payload electronically, and then the pilot would parachute out. The plane would cross the channel and explode into the target. Simple. The morning in southern England is gray with fog. Navy pilot Joe Kennedy Jr. strides across the strip toward his plane, which is packed to the gills with explosives. An engineer approaches him.
I checked out the plane, Joe. The electronic system isn't wired right. You can't fly that plane today. It could blow any time.
I'm flying, Joe said.
You don't have to, Joe. Scrub the mission. Make them check the wiring.
I'm flying, my brother insisted. Joe swings himself into the cockpit. He ignites the engine. The propellers turn. He taxis down the runway as the fog begins to lift.
Don't, Joe, don't!
I cry out through the years, even though I hated him. High over farm country, a fellow Navy man in the mother plane flipped a switch to arm the payload. The explosion that followed, it is said, was the biggest blast of the war in British skies. They did not find enough of Joe for even Pop to nominate for Congress. Air Force One stood proudly on the tarmac, America's manhood gleaming in the rising sun. The phallic notion triggers free associations. The Washington Monument, then the Lincoln Memorial, then the statue of Lincoln as it would appear in Bill Maudlin's cartoons a few days later. The great stone figure of Abe slumped over in his throne-like chair, his head in his hands, weeping, weeping for me. The overwhelming power of myth. That's what Nixon the Narrow could never grasp, that history is myth. Where's Lyndon? I asked Pierre as we mounted the portable stairs.
Lyndon's in Texas, Pierre answered. He's been there for 3 weeks, vacationing at his ranch.
Already? I didn't know that. Thus far in these recollections, I appear to be slighting my mother. I suspect that slight will continue. She was gracious and lovely and kind, and outlived us all. I intend no disrespect, but she was much less of an emotional presence than my father. While Pop's whims and outrages blew across our lives like mad typhoons, Mom saw to the needs of our daily existence, yet somehow blended into the wallpaper. Just one more rose in the garden of our lives. Try as I might to conjure images, I see only one. She is frozen in time, seated, ladylike, on a sofa. It is the Pope's sofa. The sofa and my mother are protected by velvet ropes. Throughout our childhood, Mom was physically present, feeding, nurturing, directing the hired help. And yet, in an equally real sense, she wasn't there at all. I will cite just one example, the only one I can recollect. For 3 years, as I have mentioned, my father lived in Hollywood with Gloria Swanson, the most glamorous actress of the day. Half the marquees in America billed the flick, Illicit Interlude, starring Gloria Swanson as the actress and Joseph P. Kennedy Sr. as the rich movie mogul. When the passion had waned and Pop returned home, he invited Miss Swanson for a visit. He introduced her at Hyannis as his business associate. Mom didn't blink. She shook hands, graciously. She entertained Pop's mistress with perfect class. In the next few years, Mom made 17 different pleasure trips to Europe. I think that I would rather she had blinked. She might be more vivid now in my memory. I know, I invited Angie Dickinson to my inauguration, and Jackie didn't blink. What can I tell you? Pop was a powerful teacher. So, I see Mom now in only this snapshot, seated, ladylike, on the spotless couch. It is not just any couch, not to my mother. In 1936, Cardinal Pacelli came from Italy to visit the States. He stayed for a time as our house guest. He sat at times on a sofa. When the cardinal left, Mom bought red velvet ropes and roped off the sofa on which the prelate had rested his rear. No one else would sit on it, ever. There in my memory she sits, beside, but not on, the very spot where Cardinal Pacelli sat. The lingering hint of papal incense and the red velvet ropes protect her from the dirt, from the dark profanities of life. There are, however, four stains on the sofa that the ropes could not deflect. The blood of Joe Jr., the blood of Kathleen, the blood of Bobby, and the blood of Jack. I can only assume that sometimes in private, seated on the sofa, Mother cries. But she never blinks. When we were kids, two lessons were drummed into us incessantly. The first was, win, win, win. The second was that Kennedys never cry. But when Joe exploded over Britain, my father cried. He cried for a long time. Then he turned his ambition to me. It was the 7th of February, 1960, a date which will live in infamy, as Lyndon intoned. His tone shocks me. I have never heard him so serious. Moral outrage from LBJ? I dare not question him. I don't know how much he knows. I'd been on the coast for a fundraiser getting ready for the primaries. Teddy was with me. We hopped over to Vegas to have a meal with Frank, a new family friend. Sinatra was raising money among other stars, or so I thought. We met in the lounge of the Sands. Frank showed up with a girl on his arm. This was not unusual. Frank alone would have been cause for concern. But something about the way he made the introductions, some indefinable excitement in his eyes, something vaguely businesslike in his tone, suggested that the girl wasn't his. Or that if she was, he now was through with her. Her name was Judith Campbell. The one lesson Pop had omitted, beware of Italians bearing gifts. Perhaps I should have suspected something, but with Frank, it never seemed like primping, only generosity. Or maybe that's just what I wanted to believe. Frank showed an inordinate interest in conversing with young Ted that night, which left Judy and me making eye contact as we talked. She was dark, she was pretty, she was smart. Before we finished our lobsters, I knew I had enchanted her, and she knew she had enchanted me. We went to the main ballroom then to watch Frank's show. I'd never in person seen him sing before, but from the moment the spotlight picked him out on the dark stage, I found myself riveted. There were 1,000 people in that huge room, seated on rising tiers, many behind tables midway through their meals. But the instant he started to sing, all noises ceased. Silverware stopped clicking. People stopped talking. Meals went uneaten as the audience, with its eyes, devoured Frank Sinatra. I'd never seen that happen before, such total rapture. He had a quality, a glow, when he sang in person, that was hard to define. I'd seen it only once before, somewhere, not, I know, in a club. In an odd way, it seemed political. Then I knew. Eisenhower, Ike, hero, the mastermind of D-Day, the President of the United States. Eisenhower, at his press conference and on television, was a pathetic rambler, running his sentences together like a walk in the woods, leaving his listeners lost. The man in those forums could not communicate. But Eisenhower in person, on a public stage, his smooth reddish face glowing like a baby's, was a sight to behold. The North Star, when it is the only star in the sky. A gold coin spinning in the hands of a hypnotist. The blood of the onlooker, the listener, turned to love. That's what poor Adlai had been up against. And that's what Sinatra had going for him now. An adoration, somehow induced. How he did it, I do not know. A year passed. I was already president before I got around to asking him how he did it. I don't know, he said. How do you do it? His question elated me. It still does. Perhaps Sinatra's singing that night enhanced the sudden passion between Judith Campbell and me. For the next 30 days, I telephoned Judy incessantly. We arranged, breathless, to meet at the Plaza Hotel in New York on the 7th of March, the day before the New Hampshire primary. Sinatra had done the first half of his job. The night we made the date, I dreamed again of Animal Farm. I assumed that the horses were the West, horses who, if I won the election, would gallop at my command. Now, looking back, I think of an anachronism, the severed head of a horse in a singer's bed. As World War II wound down, if that is the proper word for Hiroshima, the saga of PT-109 was the subject of a long article by John Hershey in The New Yorker. The author kindly focused on our struggle for survival and not on the prior screw-up that ditched us in the water. My father was elated and also frustrated. The circulation of The New Yorker wasn't large. He arranged with his friends at Reader's Digest for a condensation of the article, which in time went out to millions of subscribers in every city and town in America. In the condensed version, I appeared even more heroic than in the original. Learning that a congressional seat in Boston would be opening up in the 1946 election, Pop ordered 100,000 reprints of the Reader's Digest article. Then he telephoned me from Palm Beach.
How would you like to be a congressman? A member of the House of Representatives?
I held the receiver quietly for a moment.
A congressman? For Opiers.
The great engine shuddered, rumbled, roared. Air Force One taxied down the runway, gathering speed like some great beast reaching deep within itself to find its true purpose. As it lifted off the ground, flaunting its silver nose at gravity like some disdainful debutante, I was thrilled, as always, in a little boy way, at the reality of flight. It symbolized to me, I suppose, a man at his most courageous, breaking earthly chains, reaching for the highest in nature. That was why I promised we'd put a man on the moon before the decade was done. I only wish I'd lived to see it. I was a hero to you yourself, perhaps, or to your neighbors, certainly to tens of millions of Americans, to hundreds of millions around the world, the hopeless, the desperate, the simply adoring.
Kennedy! Kennedy!
It was a universal chant, if you'll recall. Nothing in this memoir disclaims that. Here be demons, perhaps. Here be woman. Here be mobsters. But here also is the Peace Corps, the Alliance for Progress, a higher minimum wage, the integration of Ole Miss, the federalization of the National Guard to integrate the schools in Alabama, the Test Ban Treaty, the removal of Khrushchev's missiles from Cuba. Yes, and that man on the moon. Never forget it. I urged you, implored you, exalted you to a higher purpose, and you responded. I put my reading glasses in my pocket, another dark secret, and looked around the room for someone to tease. Pierre wasn't there, I remember now. Pierre was off in Hawaii with half the cabinet, goofing off. Then they'd be going on to Japan for an economic conference. Pierre, quietly, would be scouting the turf. I was thinking of visiting Japan in 64. For a moment, I am upset that he isn't there. Not everyone's death is the biggest story of his life. Mine would be. You'd think your press secretary would want to be there. Poor Pierre. The contortions I put him through. I remember one time we were flying from Washington to Syracuse, New York, for a political speech. I was on Air Force One. Pierre was on the press plane trailing us. I had him announce that the president would be stopping briefly in New York for a private conference, but that no news would come of it. So the press plane would fly straight through to Syracuse.
You should have heard the shit hit the fan, as Pierre told me later.
The reporters were all over him.
We're the press corps. We go wherever the president goes. If the president's plane is touching down in New York, then the press plane is touching down in New York. We don't care if he's just going to pee. Suppose someone shoots him on the way to the men's room.
Pierre caved in. He had no choice. The entire White House press corps camped out in the lobby of the Carlisle Hotel while I spent 3 hours upstairs. Luckily, Marilyn had arrived before we did. When we were through, I called Pierre upstairs. We pondered what to do. We didn't have to explain anything, but there would be a lot of questions. It was Marilyn herself, glistening as she emerged from the shower, wrapped in a blue terry cloth robe, who had the inspiration.
I know. What about Adley?
What about Adley? I knew she still had a crush on him, her and her egghead types. I thought her bringing it up after the delights of the past few hours was not very sensitive.
He's your ambassador to the United Nations, isn't he?
The last time I looked, yes.
He lives in New York, doesn't he?
Of course. So what? Pierre said, impatient.
The UN is in session, isn't it?
Yes. No. Today's Saturday, Pierre sputtered, confused.
Precisely. But they'll be meeting again Monday. Some important questions will be coming up. Questions about which the president and the ambassador need to have a private discussion, if you get my meaning.
A broad grin split my face. Her brain, too, was a constant source of delight. Do you think we can get him over here? I mean, on such short notice, we've got to get on to Syracuse. Pierre was feeling the pressure.
If he won't come to see the president, I'm sure he'd come to see me.
I'd heard enough. Find him, I barked to Pierre. Get him over here on the double. So it was that the White House press corps, not 10 minutes later, saw Adley Stevenson emerge from a taxi in front of the Carlisle and cross the lobby to the elevators. He was wearing blue denim overalls and a plaid wool shirt. As the reporters gawked at the sight, something they had never seen before, the ambassador waited for the elevator, ignoring all questions, and rode it up to my suite. I made Marilyn wait in the bedroom while Adley and I talked. He'd been working in his rooftop garden when Pierre called. He seemed, throughout, puzzled at the sudden summons, as was the press below. I let a modest 10 minutes pass. Then I stood abruptly and shook his hand. Thank you for coming on such short notice, Ambassador. You will, of course, keep the nature of our discussions top secret, a matter of national security. Tell the press you are not at liberty to reveal what we discussed.
Of course,
he replied, shaking his head, confused. What we had discussed, mostly, were his rutabagas. He was, of course, mobbed as he recrossed the lobby in his overalls, still ignoring all questions, slipping wordlessly into a waiting cab. 10 minutes later, we headed for the airport. Marilyn, of course, would linger till we were gone.
Marilyn. Inga Binga minus Hitler. But not exactly. I was not hopelessly infatuated with Marilyn, the way I was with Inga.
That would be Bobby's problem a year later. Bobby's and Marilyn's both, and assorted agencies. The congressional elections of 1946, more than any other, would set the stage for the second half of the American century. In Massachusetts, I would win a landslide victory. In California, young Dick Nixon, he was young once, chronologically, would upset liberal Congressman Jerry Voorhees, and the good people of Wisconsin would boost into the Senate and onto a national platform a phony war hero who called himself Tail Gunner Joe McCarthy. It could be argued that I was elected to Congress because of the Boston Tea Party Kennedy style. Instead of dumping tea in the harbor, we dumped sex appeal and dreams of Kennedy wealth down the demure decolletage of thousands of quivering young ladies and their jellied moms. In the end, it was a landslide, but my election was by no means certain at the beginning. Pop spent months reestablishing his old contacts in the state for this race that Joe Jr. had been supposed to make. He spent a fortune to counter the comments that I was just a kid running for office on an old bloated incident from the war, which, of course, is what I was. Pop, in his typical self-effacing way, said it best himself.
With what I'm spending, I could elect my chauffeur.
With my back nearly killing me, I went out and made puerile speeches for 12 hours a day, doing it because Pop wanted me to, running as the ghost of young Joe. As the primary neared, someone in the campaign had an idea. The Kennedys would throw a tea party for the candidate and would invite every registered Democratic female in the district. The other candidates scoffed, but the night of the tea party at the Cambridge Hotel, more than 2,000 women lined up in the ballroom and down the carpeted stairs and out onto the street to shake hands with me and my folks. I grinned and touched their soft female flesh and thanked them for coming. They blushed and looked demure in their pastel evening dresses, many of them rented for the occasion, no doubt, from sad tuxedo shops, and their breasts flared with the wild hope that I might notice them or their daughters more than all the others, that afterward I might look them up, take them out to dinner. That tea with the Kennedys might lead, through some rub-off of the American dream, to marriage with the Kennedys. And so they stood in line through the long spring evening and waited.
6 years later, I ran for the Senate against the incumbent Republican Henry Cabot Lodge. The Lodges owned Massachusetts long before Patrick Kennedy arrived from Ireland in steerage. It was the year Ike was going to sweep the country for the GOP. No way some skinny congressman from the 11th was going to run statewide for the very first time and unseat Lodge. So how did we do it? Tea parties. We held tea parties in every district in the state. The Cambridge ladies from all over came to press the flesh. I was still the dashing bachelor with the trust fund teeth. Half of them wanted to mother me, it's true, but the other half wanted to marry me. So, in the course of the campaign against Lodge, we had 70,000 quivering ladies to tea. And on the election day, we won, statewide in the face of the Eisenhower sweep by 70,000 votes. In 1946, Pop sold all his liquor importing interests at an unbelievable profit over what he had paid for them long before. Behind him lay 3 decades of running booze, first legally, then during Prohibition, and then legally again. But it was time to quit the business, he said, so it wouldn't tarnish my career. He left behind a 30-year war with the mob. The blossoming mafia and dear old dad had battled in every port, every saloon, for the right to bring in gin. We've all seen in those great old B-movies the tactics of which the mob was capable. Since Pop more than held his own, I can only assume he employed the same tactics. That he never talked about. That same year, the man who almost single-handedly built the mob in America, Lucky Luciano, was released from prison with the gratitude of his country and allowed to return to his native Italy. Luciano controlled the dock workers in New York and California, as well as in southern Italy, where the Allies had planned to invade. From his prison cell, during the war, he ordered the mob-controlled dock workers in both countries to support with their muscle and sweat the U.S. effort, and not to side with Mussolini. The soldati on both sides of the ocean obeyed, as is their habit. When the war was over, Luciano's prison term was ended by a grateful nation. It was the first known collusion between the government of the United States and organized crime. It would not be the last. Lodge was Ike's boy. Lodge had a good liberal Republican voting record. Lodge was also a Lodge, who, as everyone knew, talked only to Cabots. And he was also a Cabot, who, as everyone knew, talked only to God. Supremely confident, Lodge went off around the country to campaign for Ike, while I went up to Massachusetts to campaign for me. I vowed that before the campaign was over, I would personally visit every city, town, and village in the state. And I did. We'd get up in a dingy hotel room at 6 a.m. and greet the workers at the factory gate. Then, on to breakfast, the lunches, the dinners. By the middle of the day, I would be walking with crutches because of my ailing back. But at each stop, I would hand the crutches to an aide backstage, then stride briskly and confidently to the rostrum, the image of health. At first, the campaign sputtered. My campaign manager quit when Pop, as always, insisted on pulling the strings from behind the scenes. Then Kenny O'Donnell had a brilliant idea. Get Bobby to run the campaign. Bobby, just out of Virginia law school, in his first job with the Justice Department, which of course Pop had gotten him, was reluctant. But we insisted, and Bobby came, and took to it like a duck to orange sauce. Bobby the tough, Bobby the ruthless, Bobby the SOB was born, allowing me to be Jack the Prince. Election night stretched into the wee hours of the morning. We sweated, we groaned, we waited. In the end, I won, by the width of a bag of Lipton. Used Lipton. Almost unbeknownst to us, huddled at Hyannis, America also elected a president that night, Ike. Dwight Eisenhower and Richard Nixon were sworn in as president and vice president on the 20th of January, 1953. At the inaugural ball that night, the new senator from Massachusetts looked dashing, as always, in his tuxedo. When the band finished Richard Nixon's favorite song, How Much Is That Doggie in the Window, Mom and Pop approached. I introduced them to my lovely date, Miss Jacqueline Bouvier. My mother, gracious as always, said,
Pleased to meet you.
My father, in his usual style, said,
Are you rich?
That was my mom and Pop. Jackie snuggled closer against my arm. Lovingly, she looked into my eyes.
Not yet, Ambassador, but soon.
I left them that way, chatting amiably. I went outside with my buddy Dave Powers to toss a football around.
Our first stop in Texas would be San Antonio. I went to my dressing room on the plane to wash up. Taped to the mirror were some figures I had asked the staff to dig out. The vote totals showing how far Lyndon and I had run behind the rest of the state Democratic ticket in 1960. I planned to use them in my speeches to fire up the party. If we couldn't carry Texas, we'd be dead in 64. Jackie, when I first met her, she was making $42.50 a week. She was the inquiring photographer for the Washington Times Herald, the exact same job that Inga used to have. How's that for coincidence? Or perversity? Despite being born a Bouvier, and after her mother remarried, raised an Auchincloss, she did not have any money of her own. But with her breeding and my trust fund, we were a perfect match. So it was that Jackie was born, or invented. To propose to her in person was impossible. It would have been humiliation, a submission of myself. That's not what women are for. I solved the dilemma by suggesting marriage in a telegram while she was traveling abroad. We had to keep the engagement a secret until after June 13th because the Saturday Evening Post was coming out with an article called Jack Kennedy, the Senate's Gay Young Bachelor. Later, when I invited her to go sailing, she was upset to discover that a Life magazine photographer would be coming with us. They'd be doing an article called Life Goes Courting with a U.S. Senator. This, I explained, is how a president begins to invent himself. We were married, united, in St. Mary's Church in Newport on September 12, 1953. Jackie's mother and stepfather paid for the lavish wedding. My father browbeat his way into making all the arrangements anyway, right down to having Archbishop Cushing officiate, though neither of Jackie's parents was Catholic. Her real father, Jack Bouvier, drank too much that morning and was not permitted to attend his daughter's wedding for fear he would create a scene before the national press. Jack Bouvier's reputation as a philanderer was the equal of Pop's. If it's true, as Freud suggested, that women marry their fathers, then Jackie had come to the right place. Who was I to disappoint her? Pop was a great admirer of Joe McCarthy. By 1950, McCarthy had become the Billy the Kid of Washington, riding down Pennsylvania Avenue, shooting up the town like some one-man outlaw gang. He was shooting blanks, of course, but people didn't realize that, and they were dropping like flies. Soon after I entered the Senate, Pop asked Uncle Joe McCarthy for a favor. He asked him to appoint Bobby chief counsel of his subcommittee on investigations. I was enraged, but there was nothing I could do. Bobby got the job, not as chief counsel, but as an assistant to McCarthy's new superboy, Roy Kahn. Bobby was 27 when he went to work for McCarthy. He quit after 6 months, but the association would hound him for the rest of his life. "Lie down with dogs," Lyndon quipped. I know, Lyndon." While the nation, in 1954, was preoccupied with Army McCarthy, with the Senate debate over censuring its chief badger, an event was taking place in my family, the critical importance of which has been overlooked by virtually all of my biographers. My sister Patricia was getting married. It was not her nuptials that were important so much as her choice of husband, Peter Lawford, the actor. Lawford was a member of Hollywood's notorious Rat Pack, that nucleus of fast-living actors and red-headed reincarnees whose members included Dean Martin, Sammy Davis Jr., Joey Bishop, and Shirley MacLaine. The leader of the pack, of course, was Frank Sinatra. At the vast wedding reception, while the champagne flowed like the River Charles amid islands of caviar, I maneuvered my new brother-in-law into a corner. We watched Sinatra holding court with his toadies across the room. "Tell me about Sinatra."
"He's a singer,"
Lawford responded helpfully. "Yes, Peter," I queried.
"He's also an actor. Made a hell of a Maggio. Did you see From Here to Eternity?"
Just tell me about his women, Peter." Lawford looked at his shiny gold watch.
"I've got a honeymoon to go on, and the Senate doesn't adjourn until when? August? Catch me when you've got more time."
Just one story," I pressed. Pop approached, champagne glass filled with club soda in his hand, to listen to the conversation.
"All right, one,"
Peter agreed reluctantly.
The only thing that competes with girls in his brain is a fascination with violence. A few months ago, at a party in Palm Springs, he got so mad at a chick he threw her through a window. There was blood all over the place. Poor girl's arm was nearly severed. Frank just stood there, sipping his drink, while other people rushed her to the hospital.
How come she didn't sue? How come it wasn't in the newspapers?
Frank paid her off to keep it quiet.
As I listened, shaking my head, Pop swallowed the last of his club soda.
I want to meet this man,
Pop said. We moved across the crowded ballroom to Sinatra's enclave. Lawford made the introductions.
I've heard a lot about you, Ambassador. From some friends of mine. You know, paisans,
Frank said to Pop. He turned to me, his blue eyes twinkling.
You're the senator, he said. The one with the bright future. I hear Peter and Pat have bought Louis B. Mayer's house in Santa Monica. If they invite you out, look me up. Maybe we can do some hunting together.
Hunting? My brain softened by champagne. In Santa Monica? Then I understood.
I'd like that, I said, as our eyes met and locked.
In the next few years, Frank and I did a lot of hunting together. In New York, in Las Vegas, in Palm Springs. It was all good sport, though we did not wear plaid shirts or bright orange vests or much of anything. J. Edgar Hoover, between framing commies, kept track of my hunting career as he had been doing ever since Inga. When Bobby took over the Justice Department years later, he found the following note in its files. It is a known fact that the Sands Hotel is owned by hoodlums, and that while the Senator, Sinatra, and Lawford were there, showgirls from all over town were running in and out of the Senator's suite. In all my years of hanging out with Sinatra, the Jack Pack, as he sometimes called it, what struck me most was not his way with women. It was, more, the implication of the anecdote Peter had told me about the girl shoved through the window. Frank Sinatra appeared capable of doing anything in the world he felt like doing without having to pay the consequences. When I decided to seek the vice presidency in 1956 and the presidency in 1960, I was running out of pure ambition. I was running because that's what Kennedys were for, to run, 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 win, win, win. I was running for Pop out of fear, and for Joe Jr. out of spite, and for old Patrick Kennedy, who came here from Ireland and died of cholera on the 22nd of November, to justify his transatlantic passage. Those are not the best reasons to run for president, and after 25 years, I am beginning to feel ashamed. When the French garrison at Dien Bien Phu came under heavy siege, when there was a talk of sending American troops to rescue the French, I made a major address on the subject in the Senate, quoth I. To pour money, material, and men into the jungles of Indochina without at least a remote prospect of victory would be dangerously futile and self-destructive. I am frankly of the belief that no amount of American military assistance in Indochina can conquer an enemy that is everywhere and, at the same time, nowhere. After the 64 election, I was going to do it. I was going to bring home the boys from Vietnam. I was going to risk being the most unpopular president in history. But I was going to do it. I was going to end that stupid little war.
You and what army?
Lyndon jibes. Instinctively, we check ourselves. There is, behind us, up where we are now, in the middle distance, a large and leaden cloud. They lie sprawled upon it in positions of repose that somehow still seem grotesque. The cloud of the recent slaughtered. They are military and civilian. White, yellow, black. They are young and old. Men and women, boys and girls. Ours and theirs. There is no north on the cloud, no south. They sprawl wherever there is room, intermingled. Each night at sunset, it is the first cloud in the sky to run red. We have been told, Lyndon and I, that they are whole again, that their spirits are as restful as anyone's. Still, we try never to turn, Lyndon and I. We try never to look at them. It is this, I suspect, that has made us friends. One evening, not long ago, they sent an emissary to visit us here. She was a dark-haired Vietnamese girl from the South, I believe. She looked familiar somehow, and when she said her name was Kim, I knew. I had seen a famous photograph of this Kim, a lovely teenager then, standing naked on a dirt road, somewhere beneath the strafing plains, screaming. A universal, timeless plea for peace. She was as lovely as ever on her visit, wearing now a diaphanous white gown. She had come, she said, as a representative of all of them. They wanted us to know, she said, that we were forgiven. They wanted us to know that we were welcome. They would like us to visit their cloud. She had dark eyes and rare beauty and young wisdom. We thanked her for her tenderness. We told her we were grateful for her visit. We told her we were moved by her request. We watched as she retreated on a zephyr, retreated to the cloud of lead. We have not yet found the nerve, Lyndon and I, to make our visit. In 1956, the United States would not be holding an election. It would be holding a referendum on Grandpa. The question before the voters would be, should kindly old Grandpa be kicked out of the house, made to go sleep in the barn alongside the cows and the hogs, eat what slop the dogs didn't devour? Chosen to uphold the Democratic affirmative, chosen to run against Ike, would be, again, the man from Illinois, sadly with Adley. He was, legend has it, perhaps the most intellectual candidate to run for president in this century, and perhaps since Thomas Jefferson. It is my contention that agreeing to run again that year, he called into question his very ability to govern. I thought then that it would be better to make the race and lose than to remain on the sidelines. I'd still be in a strong position for 1960 when Adlai would be nobody's darling. I sent Sorensen around the country testing the waters for a Catholic Veep. He came back with the news that it might really strengthen the ticket, reverse the working-class war hero tide that had flowed toward Ike in 52. We made this known to the Gladly with Adlai crowd. My father cabled me from a vacation on the Riviera with one of his typical votes of confidence in my abilities.
If you are chosen, it'll be because you are a Catholic and not because you're big enough to do the job.
Thanks again, Dad. The simple fact is, I was telegenic, the most telegenic politician in the country, the critic for the New York Times wrote. With each new appearance on Murrow's Meet the Press or whatever, my image began to impress itself upon the retina of the nation. Handsome, strong, witty, idealistic, self-deprecating. Television had wired America, and that myriad of electronic microdots all by themselves created a minor boomlet. Kennedy as a possible choice for vice president. In return for my early endorsement, Adlai picked me to narrate a film on the history of the party that would be shown at the opening of the convention. The date was Monday, August 13th. That afternoon, I was still primarily the senator from Massachusetts. By the time the film ended that night, to the thundering applause of 11,000 cheering delegates, I was the third legitimate contender for the vice presidential spot, along with Estes Kefauver, who had contended with Adlai for the nomination itself, and Hubert Humphrey, darling of the civil rights wing of the party. Estes was known as a crime fighter, Hubert as a libertarian, but after that, I was bigger than both of them. After that, I was a movie star. The battle for delegates was fierce. On the first ballot, Kefauver led with 483.5 votes. But the big story was that I came in second with a strong 304. On the second ballot, New York delivered its huge delegation to me. And then, to the surprise of most of the hall, Lyndon Johnson stood up and announced,
Texas proudly casts its vote for the fighting sailor who wears the scars of battle.
It was your finest hour, Bobby said later. The stampede, to me, was on. At the end of the second ballot, Kefauver had 551.5 votes, and I had vaulted past him with 618, only 33.5 votes short of victory. The hour grew late. Across the country, 40 million TV viewers were glued to their sets watching. But on the third ballot, when the West and the Midwest stood firm for Kefauver, some of the Southerners started switching to him. Estes would be the nominee. I headed for the amphitheater. I mounted lightly to the rostrum. I grinned the grin that everyone called infectious. What I had succeeded in doing, of course, by following my own instincts, was both have my cake and eat it too. I achieved all that national exposure, made millions of new fans across the country, and still could not be held responsible when Adlai and Estes drowned in the Eisenhower Sea. It was a public relations triumph, achieved squarely against the advice of Pop. That was the sweetest taste of all. On Thanksgiving, the whole clan gathered at Hyannisport for a family feast. After dinner, Pop and I went into the study alone to discuss the future. Pop wanted me to run in 1960, not for vice president, as the press was already speculating, but for the top spot, for president. I played the devil's advocate. I listed all the negatives. I was still young. I was a Catholic. I had little support from the party leaders. To all of these, Pop had a positive answer, which, of course, is precisely what I wanted. When he was through, I stood up. "Well, Dad, I guess there's only one question left. When do we start?" Dad stood and came close. He threw his arms around me. He hugged me tight. At that moment, I believe, we buried Joe Jr. at last and set my own course clear. As we stepped off the plane, the warmth of Texas in late November was a surprise. I'd been given a chillier forecast. I was concerned as we moved down the aluminum stairs that Jackie might be too warm in the clothes she'd brought. Lyndon and Lady Bird were waiting for us at the bottom of the stairs, as were Governor and Mrs. Connolly. We shook hands and climbed into the waiting limousines. The motorcade rolled across the airport tarmac and out onto a highway. We were going first to Brooks Air Force Base, where I was to speak at the dedication of a new Air Force School of Aerospace Medicine. The crowds lining the streets between the airport and the base were dense and cheering wildly, about 125,000 people. Kids waved American flags. A bum broke through the police lines to touch me. A sign urged Jackie to come water ski in Texas. When we reached the medical center, 20,000 people were trying to squeeze their way into 9,000 seats. I talked about the space program, told them how committed we were. It symbolized for me the new frontiers we hoped to reach in every aspect of American life. There were more cheering crowds as the motorcade wound back toward the San Antonio airport. We'd gotten plenty of warnings not to go to Texas, but as far as I knew, the state had not yet seceded from the Union. It would still have a bunch of delegates in the next election, and judging from the San Antonio crowds, we would do just fine. What follows is straight history. But if this were a movie, there would be, starting in the background, the faint strains of eerie music, violins most likely, joining with heavy hidden pianos in an unexpected thunderous crescendo.
Oh, Seekers, there you go. I, JFK by Robert Mayer. That was just part one. You have two more chunks of this to look forward to, and oh man, you have no idea where it's going. Good night, Seekers.
Kill JFK.